I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
John, like a bad penny or a ripped dollar bill, we're back.
I know. And I'm excited to be back. We've missed a little bit, and maybe we'll get into that in a future Just the Two of Us episode. But we're happy to be back, and we've got a great guest today. His name is Ryder Carroll. Ryder is a digital product designer and inventor of the Bullet Journal. He's partnered with companies like Adidas, American Express, Cisco, IDM, Macy's, and HP. He's been featured by the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Fast Company, Bloomberg, Lifehacker, and Mashable, and recently gave a TEDx talk. He's got a brand new book out called The Bullet Journal Method, Track the Past, Order the Present, Design the Future. Ryder, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. You know, one of the things I picked up going through your book, which I think is a really great way, and I guess maybe some of the philosophy behind what you have going on with the Bullet Journal Method, and that is that it is the analog system for the digital age. And maybe you can explain a little bit what you mean by that, having this thing be an analog system for the digital world we live in.
Sure. So I've been a digital product designer for a very long time, and it's not about like not using technology. Obviously, that would be silly, but I found myself in a place where even though I was using the most cutting edge productivity systems and apps and all these different things, I wasn't in fact being more productive. And I found that every time I would start writing things down, I would be able to focus and get organized a lot faster, essentially. And over time, you know, more I paid attention to that, I realized that there needs to be a balance between the two. Like, where technology is really wonderful at connecting us with the world around us, it seems to fail at helping us connect with the world within us. And I think that's a very important space. It's a space where I do a lot of my thinking and prioritizing and clarification, and I do so undistracted. I do it offline. You know, a lot of times when I was using apps, I'd be getting really organized and setting everything up and all these things, and the next thing I know, I'm like buying shoes, and I actually didn't get anything done. And you know, technology has become so seamless that you can just engage with it indefinitely. And sometimes it's easy to lose your thread. But when I'm using my notebook, I'm actually applying the bullet journal method. I found that it allowed me to become significantly more productive, even though it may seem that writing things out by hand seems like a big technological step back and is a little bit outdated. But I found that there needs to be a balance for the two, at least in my own life.
I think, you know, many of our guests are authors. A lot of them are fiction authors, particularly in genre fiction. And I think this is especially nowadays, and it gets more and more every year, this is a challenge that I think everybody faces, especially people who work in creative fields, where they have to find a way to give themselves distance from their digital tools and the internet specifically. And it's so easy to go down, let's say you're a writer and you need to do a little bit of research on something that you're writing about. And it's so easy, then now you're in Wikipedia, now you're going down a rabbit hole and you didn't actually get any writing done. And you may be looking at stuff that has nothing to do with what you were looking up in the first place, but it's so easy to get caught there. And I know we've had some authors that they'll just unplug their Wi-Fi, or they'll have certain apps that will shut them out of the internet for specific periods of time. And this is a thing that I hear come up quite often, ways that creative people will block themselves from the internet, from their digital tools, in order so they can get the kind of work done that they want to.
John, can you hold on a second? I'm checking a tweet.
Oh. Nice. So, yeah, I think this is something, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to get Ryder on the show, because I feel like so many of our listeners, whether they be writers or readers, they struggle with this. What is the balance? And I think Ryder's book and a lot of the philosophy behind it can be very useful to the people that listen to the show. Before we get into the nitty gritty of some of the things in the book, I'd first like to thank everybody that supports the show, that backs us on Patreon. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/functionalnerds for those people who are backing us for $1 a month or a couple of dollars a month. Patrick and I really appreciate it. It helps us get great guests like Ryder here and have interesting conversations every week. And for those people who are already doing it, we really thank you. And for the people that are not doing it, but maybe you might want to consider it, again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Ryder, do you have a pick prepared?
Yes, I've been reading Sapiens, which I think is a really fascinating look at the history of humanity.
And what are some of the things that you're getting out of it right now that are affecting you?
Well, it's interesting. It's when I took like history class, a lot of times it's very clear cut, you know, it's just fact after fact after fact. And there's not a lot of connective tissue. Right. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this book, it has a very unique way of contextualizing how we evolved and how culture and civilization has evolved and how the different models that we've introduced into our societies have helped us survive, understand the world for better or for worse, just in a way that I hadn't really ever thought about it before. The author clearly has an ability to draw relationships that may not at first seem obvious. And I'm not done yet, but I'm fully enthralled. I'm currently on book tour, and this has been a nice way to unplug and just think of something completely different, which is helpful.
Yeah, that's a book that I bought about a year or two ago whenever it came out. And then there's the follow-up as well, which I can't think of. I bought that one too. So they're sitting there waiting for me. They're intimidating looking books. They're both rather long, I believe, if I'm not mistake, and I have them both in ebooks, so I'm not even sure. But I for one, I'm looking forward to getting into those as well. So thank you for the pick. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
I'm going to go with something on Netflix. I've been watching. I'm almost done with it. I started it around Halloween-ish, and I've just been doing one episode, and then I usually have to watch something else just to kind of it's pretty intense, so I have to watch something else to sort of cleanse the palate afterwards. But it's the Haunting of Hill House.
Okay, yeah, the horror thing, right?
The horror, and it's really, really good, I think. And very intense, lots going on in it. I love the characters. They're all so very well developed and damaged at the same time. And it's just been, it's been a really great show. Very creepy, and I just recommend it. So yeah, Haunting of Hill House. I'm trying not to spoil anything.
Yeah, I know it's hard when you pick these things to try not to spoil them, but true. Cool. My pick is a book, and I suspect that that Ryder read this book too, from going through his book. As our listeners know, over the past say 2 years or so, I've been reading a lot of the Stoicism, the Stoic philosophy. And this is actually a reread of mine, because I think this was the book that kind of kicked it off for me. I think I read it about 4 years ago first, and I just read it in the past 2 weeks again, reread it, I should say. And that is The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumphs by Ryan Holiday, who I talk about a lot. I basically just read everything that he puts out. I've become a big fan of his work. And I didn't realize until I started rereading this, how this actually did get me kind of started on all of the Stoic philosophy. And it's a rather short book, but there's a lot packed into it. And the title says it all, how you can use whatever obstacles, whatever misfortune you may be experiencing in life, and how to use that to how that becomes the way. Whatever is in your path becomes the path. And it's been very useful for me lately. I've had some stuff going on, as we all do in our life, and rereading this has really been a great comfort and a great way to deal with challenges that everybody has to deal with at one point or the other. So if you haven't read this book, I recommend it. Again, it's a short book, The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. And I think that kind of dovetails nicely into what Ryder is talking about, because quite a bit throughout the bullet journal method, there is quite a few references to Stoicism. And so Ryder, maybe you can tell us, am I wrong in that that assessment, that Stoicism has that effect on how you go about doing things?
Yes, it definitely has an effect, certainly. I think what drew me into Stoicism first and foremost was a concept, right? And that was the way that they think about control, and they break it down into what can you and what can't you control, which I think also kind of dovetails into change. Like, if you want your circumstances to change, you first have to figure out what's in your control and what isn't. And they were able to distill it in a way that I thought was incredibly valuable and practical, which is to say the only thing in life that you can control is how you respond to your circumstances. You can't necessarily control your circumstances, the people in your life, you know, the world around you, but you can control the way that you respond. And it's such a simple observation, but one that when I read it, I literally stopped and just thought about that for a second, because I realized that I think I've put myself through so much agony worrying about things that are completely out of my control. And I realized that, like, that wasn't serving me. And it's kind of an automatic response, like, what if this and what if that, and all this doubt and fear and anxiety. And I realized that I was just investing so much time and energy into something that I in no way could control. So the question becomes, what could I control? And asking myself that question on an ongoing basis has been really helpful. Clearly, it doesn't make me immune from worrying about things, but it helps me check myself and actually take that time and energy invested in something that I can control.
One of the quotes I pulled out of your book, one of your quotes actually, you just mentioned worry, is that worry baits us with the promise of a solution, but usually offers none. Maybe you can expand on that a bit.
Sure. So a lot of times we worry about all these outcomes, right? And then I think that we get caught up in trying to think our way through all these different scenarios. And by and large, none of them will happen, right? And this doesn't mean that a bad thing won't happen or a good thing won't happen. It just will happen in a way that you didn't anticipate. And I think that we get caught up in worrying about these things because we believe if we figure out what the outcome is going to be, then we can prepare ourselves for it. And it promises us an answer. And that's what you really want. When you're worried, it means that there's massive uncertainty in some respect. And we really don't deal well with uncertainty. Uncertainty is not something we can put our hands on necessarily. We can't fix uncertainty. So I think that if we spend all of our time and energy worrying about things, we distract ourselves from the things that we could be doing to improve a situation.
I would agree with that. And I think what happens when we worry, we're feeling this anxiety or this stress. And I think our natural inclination as people is to, like, how can I get rid of this anxiety and stress? So let me think about all the ways. And it always comes back to what you just said. Most of the time, those things are not things that we can control. We try to figure out ways that we could control them, but quite often we can't. And as you said, it holds us back from doing the things that we can control, that we can make our situation better. And it's a big waste of energy quite a lot. And I really like how you put that with worry. Another thing that you had mentioned in that is you were talking about responding, and you do talk a little bit in the book about reacting versus responding. And maybe you can define what the difference between reacting and responding are, because a lot of times people may think those are the same things, but they're really not. So how would you describe the difference between reacting and responding?
I would say it's a matter of time. I would, you know, they can be very similar, but if I had to boil it down, I think it's time. When you react, generally speaking, you hear like knee-jerk reaction if somebody says something to you at, I don't know, work or something that's really offensive, you might just react by snapping back or shooting that email that really wasn't thought through that well, something like that. You do that because your wall goes up and you try to defend yourself instantly. And responding to me means that I take a step back, kind of process what just happened, figure out what can I do in this situation, right? And by and large, when you respond, it's because you are taking action with intention as opposed to just reacting, if you know what I mean. So let's go back to the work example. If something happens at work and you're having problems with a colleague, you can either like shoot off this heated email that doesn't make any of you look good and chances are it'll escalate a situation or deteriorate it. Or you could take a step back, you know, try not to take the bait and then think about like, what are proper responses to this? What are ways that you could turn this to be more productive or at least de-escalate the situation? And that takes just a little bit of time and thought, which a lot of times takes work also, because if somebody makes you really angry, chances are you're not thinking all that clearly. But when you start getting in the habit of taking a step back, when you start feeling yourself rising, I guess you would say, then you're like, okay, you immediately check the fact that your body feels a certain way. And you can take a step back and be like, okay, this is the situation currently. What can I control? How will I respond? So for me, the difference is one is mindless and one is mindful, if you will. One is done with intention and one is not.
Now, talking about intentional and your intentions, one of the quotes that you start one of the chapters off with is from Richie Norton. It's intentional living is the art of making your own choices before other choices make us. And maybe you can explain that one a little bit to us.
Sure. So I believe we live in a day and age where we're just bombarded by opinions and by representations of what life could be. So for example, when you're going through your Instagram feed or Facebook, people aren't necessarily posting pictures of them having a dull day, right? They're not posting a picture of themselves when they're looking bad, unless they're looking terrible, which is there to, again, for a very specific response. But by and large, when we see other people's lives, these are high points. And I think we tend to forget that all the time. So people on vacation, buying a house, having kids, you know, you name it. And all of a sudden you're like, that's their reality. That is reality in general. Like, these are the things that I should be working towards. And a lot of these concepts follow themes like wealth and power and fame and all these things. And because we see it so often, that starts to form a narrative for us automatically. It's like, okay, in order to be happy, I need to be rich. In order to be happy, I need to have this house. I need to have these things. And we just kind of take that for granted that that is what happiness looks like. That is what the goal should be. And what's happening in that is that other people are setting the goals for us. And sometimes they align, but in my own experience, oftentimes they don't, right? Because you don't know what it's like to be rich. Right? And what does rich mean exactly? Is it $1 million? Is that $10 million? What happens when you have $1 million? Does that mean that you're just going to be happy? What are you going to use the money for? Like, all of a sudden these goals start fracturing a little bit, you know? And in my own experience, you know, they said, as a designer, you should have your own company making your own thing. I'm like, okay, great. That's going to make me happy. I did that and it didn't. And it didn't because I didn't know what was important to me because I hadn't asked. And that was a real revelation. You know, I launched a company after 2 years of intense work, like sacrificing pretty much everything else, my free time, you know, my social life, all this stuff. After 2 years, I launched, the company was profitable, humbly. And I showed up a week later to work and I was like, I just don't care. And that was like a real wake up call. Like, the product's fine. You know, like it's, it's, it, it wasn't something I was necessarily embarrassed about. I just had, you know, they say the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. And I found that to be true. It's like, I don't want to be indifferent about what I'm spending so much time and energy on. So what do I know makes me feel curious? What really engages me? And from that point onward, I spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I realized two things. One is that they usually didn't align with the things that I was seeing elsewhere, right? I had adopted other people's goals. They were making choices for me. And I just was on autopilot. I'm like, okay, cool. I'll do that. So on the one hand, I realized that I should be paying more attention to the things that I want and that I think are important. And I didn't really have answers for that. So it took work to figure out what it was that I actually responded to, things that I was engaged by. And I had just become more sensitive to that and pay much closer attention, which is work. But all of a sudden that work paid off big time because I was like, oh, I like this. How do I spend more time here? You know, like the goal is spending more time doing this. And then the second thing that I learned is that they change all the time, right? It's like you set a goal, you accomplish the goal, and maybe you're satisfied, maybe you're not, but chances are you're not done. You're not finished, you know, and like now comes the next goal and the next goal. So it has to be an ongoing process. And the idea of you knowing what you want 5 or 10 years from now may, I think, is questionable. I think setting long-term goals is good just to kind of give you some kind of framework to work towards, right? So you're not just guessing. But at the same time, I think it's really important to realize that those goals will change and that you give yourself permission to adjust accordingly as you learn more about yourself, as your interests change, as you evolve. And I feel like if you don't do that, you're constantly just adopting ideas from other people that have a very high likelihood of leaving you feeling completely lost.
An interesting statistic that you point out on this topic is that a hunger for more is prompting millennials to spend twice as much per month on self-improvement as baby boomers, despite earning about half as much. Maybe you could talk about that because that was a surprising fact. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And I don't know if you are in, and you don't have to tell us your age or anything, but I don't know if you would consider yourself part of the millennial generation or not. Patrick and I are both in our mid 40s, so we are not millennials, but I think millennials get beat up pretty good, especially, and that's just common. The older generations tend to beat up the younger ones. But I thought that was an interesting fact that they spend so much on self-improvement because of that hunger for more, as you were almost just describing.
Yeah, I'm not a millennial. I think it's just because like self-improvement in general is not as taboo as it used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was growing up, you go to the bookshelf and if somebody's in the self-help section, you kind of like give them the duck eye. It's like, what's going on over there? Right. And I always thought that was curious because I've always needed help, but there was kind of a stigma attached to it. And I think that's gone. Like that stigma is gone. If anything, if you're not doing something to improve yourself in some way, that's questionable now, right? It's like, because everybody can improve. There's no question about that. And now the market is just flooded with resources.
But can't you take it too far? Can't you concentrate so much on that you're dropping all the other things in your life that you should be looking at and working on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that you can take anything to extreme, including self-improvement, right? And I think that like this is a perfect example of this. If you spend all your time self-improving, it's like, what are you improving exactly? I feel like improvement needs to be in response to a challenge. Like, what are your weaknesses exactly? And I think the only way you get to discover that is engaging with the real world. You go to work, you make mistakes, you know, you start companies that don't work out or you start companies that do that leave you empty. It's like, I think self-improvement needs to be used as a tool, and a tool needs to be picked based on the work at hand, right? It's everything we build has to have a very specific purpose. And I think that if you do self-improvement for self-improvement's sake, all of a sudden you can be completely overwhelmed and spend all day meditating, doing yoga, you know, zero waste. You can spend all your time there because there's a million ways to improve theoretically, but by what measure, by what standard? And I think that standard is established by your actual lived experience. Just because this helps somebody else improve, you know, it doesn't necessarily relate to your own experience. I think a lot of people get caught up in this stuff. So I feel like with any tool, you have to figure out what it is that you're trying to solve or fix or trying to build before you engage in something heavily. And the same thing's true for productivity, right? I think productivity can be its own form of distraction. We kind of worship productivity. It's like, if you're being productive, then things are good. And I feel like that's not true either, because a lot of times people can be working very productively towards empty goals, as I'd mentioned before. So I think, again, you have to be very careful about what you're spending your time and energy pursuing.
You have on that subject, you have a fantastic quote to start one of your chapters by Peter Drucker, which I've come across this one before, but there's nothing quite so useless as doing with great efficiency something that should not be done at all. And I think we've all been guilty of that. Maybe you can give an example of what are some things that you think people could be working on that they're putting too much time toward?
Well, I mean,
corporate meetings. We don't need as many. They're pointless.
Yeah, I'll second that. I've been guilty and victim to that.
We're gonna have a meeting to discuss what the topic should be at our next meeting.
I've had those, and I've had emails titled that way, and people think it's like, is this a joke? You know,
it's not.
I think that, again, productivity is a big one. I think that productivity gives us a sense of control, right? Because you're getting everything organized and you're trying to get focused, but all of a sudden 3 days later, like, you have made no progress towards the thing that you're actually building. So I think that we have to take a step back and always be very mindful about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. Not necessarily setting an expectation, but knowing where you're headed, which is very different, right? Like, here's the goal. This is what needs to be done. And then asking yourself, why does this need to be done? It's like, everybody knows that meetings need to be had. And the idea is to get everybody on the same page, but is to have a meeting to get everybody on the same page, to get everybody on the same page, to get everybody on the same page. You know, at some point, it's like, why are we doing this? Is this a page that we should be writing in the first place? So I think that, and I've been guilty of this myself. I've been incredibly productive working towards things that should have just never existed. And they wouldn't have if I'd just taken a step back and be like, what value is this adding to my life or to my client's life or to the client, depending on, you know, what hat I was wearing at the time. And then a lot of times those questions seem to get lost. And those, I think, feel like those are the first things that need to be answered.
In a performance review recently, I was told that I seem to excel when I am working independently on my own, and that if I'm working in small groups, that seems fine. But the larger the group, the less productive I appear to be. And I said, well, that's because the larger the group, the less productive we all are, because all we're doing is having meeting after meeting after meeting, and nothing is getting accomplished. And that, I think, is a core foundational tenet of corporate America. It's like, you have to have a meeting for the sake of having a meeting. And people aren't necessarily setting, like, individuals set goals, I think, and individuals set tasks for themselves, and they know that they have to get stuff done. But when you, especially in a group dynamic, it gets far more difficult to kind of cut through all the red tape and get down to what actually needs to be done and then do it.
Absolutely. You're like increasing complexity with each head, right? And the smaller the team, the more likely it is that you can find consensus on what is a priority. But the more opinions there are, the more cooks there are in the kitchen, that becomes diluted to a point of complete abstraction at some point, at least in my experience. Like, what is the priority? And then group A thinks it's this, group B thinks it's that, and who's calling the shot? Is it group A, group B? Yeah, I completely understand. The more people, the more complex any problem becomes, I believe.
Another interesting fact, which I was unaware of that you mentioned is that there was in 2016, there was a productivity decrease in the United States, considering how focused we are on improving our productivity. Now we're seeing a decrease in it. And what do you think is the reason for that? Why do you think there is a decrease in productivity these days?
I mean, I think that it's due to a host of different reasons, right? But I think it, one that makes sense to me that might not seem immediately obvious is the fact that technology not that long ago, especially in the productivity space, used to be a real novelty. And people who knew their way around these apps or introduced them were way ahead of the curve. But now it's a requirement to be fluent in all these different technologies. So when it was a novelty, it means that it was new. There were powers there that were being promised that we didn't have available before. And by and large, I think that increased our productivity significantly, especially with collaboration. But now it's the standard, right? So what happens now? It's like we've kind of like evened out and now starting the productivity decrease. It's because technology is limitless, right? You can use apps all day long. You can engage with this all day long. And the major problem is that we're very limited. We have very limited time, energy, attention. So we're working with tools that can engage us for periods of time that we're not really equipped to handle. And I think that we're starting to see that now, right? It's just because they're more and bigger and better tools doesn't mean that we can really take full advantage of them or that they're really designed the way that our brains are designed to work, the way that our bodies are designed to work. So in my own experience, I felt like that's where I had to start taking a step back from technology and looking for other alternatives and then actually fully embracing the fact that I get tired and that I get confused and that you know, I get overwhelmed and all these things. And once I started doing that, I think my own relationship with technology became much healthier, I guess. And then those tools, when I re-engaged with those tools, knowing exactly what priorities were, then I was able to make significantly more progress.
So I think you're talking about things like Slack and Trello and Asana and all these quote unquote productivity suites that are being adopted across the board.
Yeah. I mean, again, bigger and more powerful doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. And especially like, the challenge with a lot of apps is also very real. It's how do we serve the most amount of people and situations possible? And then you get into this kind of situation where it's like, okay, we can. It's so flexible that nobody knows where to begin. And two people's opinions of how it can be effective for them may differ in a really problematic way. So yeah, the tool is incredibly powerful potentially, but is it making you more productive?
Yeah, I continue to go back to my notebook and I write stuff down or I use Evernote, you know, and I just write my notes down and I kind of keep track of what I have to do. And that's how I continue to be productive.
Well, and I think that really kind of brings it full circle to what Ryder has done with the bullet journal, which is a notebook. it is an analog notebook that, you can design it to use it the way you'd like, whatever way works best for you. But I think that what he talks about in the book that's out now is how you can use that to organize your thoughts, how you can use that to prioritize things, to break through the clutter of the world that we live in now, which is just getting more cluttered every day. And Ryder has a big community online that has adopted this method. And I know it has helped him out quite a bit developing this over the years. And it seems like a really good tool that I think many of our listeners could use. If you're all the stuff that we've been talking about today, if this rings true, which I suspect it does for quite a few of you listening right now, check out the book. It's called The Bullet Journal Method. It is, and it's by our guest today, Ryder Carol, R-Y-D-E-R, Carol. It's out there. I was out in the mall yesterday with my son, and we were walking around, and we went into the Books a Million, and there were a bunch of copies right there. So it's out there. Check it out. I think it could be something useful. And for folks who like a lot of the stuff that I often talk about, I feel like Ryder and I have read a lot of the same stuff. You like a lot of the things that I, a lot of the nonfiction that I talk about quite a bit. It certainly seems like that is in the philosophy of this book. And Ryder, anything else you want to tell our listeners about in regards to this book before we start wrapping it up today?
There is one thing. So a lot of people encounter Bullet Journal the first time when they see it on Instagram or Pinterest. And there's some very, very elaborate interpretations of the underlying system and practice. So for those who may have seen it, I would submit for your consideration to go to bulletjournal.com instead and start there, because I designed it to be as lean and requiring the least amount of time possible to keep you productive. Some of the things that you see online work for those users and their specific use case, but it doesn't need to look like that in any way. It's all about the content, not about the presentation.
Fantastic. So once again, the Bullet Journal method, it is out there now. Anything else you want to let our listeners know about? Any other projects or things that are in the works, or anything else that, or ways that they can connect with you online? Anything you want to leave them with before we go?
Sure. So if you're interested in Bullet Journal, you can go to bulletjournal.com. We're also at Bullet Journal everywhere. And that's pretty much what I'm focused on full time now.
Fantastic. For us this week, thanks again for listening. I hope you got a lot out of this conversation. If you dig the show, again, thanks to people that are already backing us. And if you aren't already, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
The key to a productive day begins with a Santiago's breakfast burrito.
I can't think of a better way to end the show than talking about breakfast burritos. All right, everybody. Well, have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.